Thanks for staying with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We've come a long way in food manufacturing and safety. We were just talking about farm-to-lunch room programs by Hydroponic Gardens in the Menasha School District. We are going to compare that to the introduction of food protection laws at the turn of the century, or maybe the lack of food production protection laws. We'll talk with Deborah Blum. Deborah is the director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT, Pulitzer Prize winner, and a New York Times bestselling author. She wrote the book we'll be talking about today. It's called The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. So, what questions do you have about the history of food regulation in the U.S.? Do you have concerns about food regulation today? What's your opinion about additives? There are a lot of things we can talk about with her today, and I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Deborah Blum joins us by phone today. Deborah, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Good to talk with you again.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on. It's great to hear your voice.
Well, I tell you what, I read your book and I'm thinking, oh, my goodness me. I had no idea. I knew things were kind of bad back then, but I had no idea of the kinds of additives and things that processors were putting in our food back then. Maybe you can talk about what the situation was like and what were some of the things that processors and so forth were using.
It was crazy, right? And I realized when I was researching the book that I had bought into this mythology of the kind of pink-cheeked, healthy diet of the 19th century when it was just insanely corrupt in a sense. I mean, what you have to realize is this is before any regulation at all. So food manufacturers have license to do whatever with food. And so you saw, especially with the rise of the Industrial Revolution, this moment in American time when the food is very bad on two fronts. One is fraud, and one is, well, we can put any chemical compound we want into food, and it's all legal. So just to give you a couple of examples, I'll do fraud and then I'll do really bad stuff.
Okay.
But I'll try to do it very quickly. So food fraud was rampant in the late 19th century. And the scientist I wrote about, Harvey Wiley, actually started the first federal investigations of the state of American food. And they would look at things like spices, where they discovered that pepper was quite often sawdust dyed with lead, and that cinnamon was quite often just brick dust, and that flour was mixed with ground stone or gypsum, the stuff we use in wallboard. And this was at 80 or 90% fraud, right? Or going over to very bad things. I'm bitter, and that coffee, I should just stop and say, because coffee's super important to me. But coffee was quite often, you know, charred bone, or, you know, seeds dyed black, or one of my favorite parts of the coffee story is people became very suspicious of ground coffee because of all this fraud, and they started grinding their own beans. Then there's a new industry in fake coffee beans, which were mostly dirt and wax, right?
There was no coffee in coffee in some cases.
There was no coffee in coffee. What were they drinking? And I actually read a statement from a doctor in Indiana about this time who said he thought the origin of the phrase a muddy cup of coffee was because Americans were drinking so much mud instead of coffee. It was crazy. And at the same time, some of the things that food producers were doing to improve the look of food or to stabilize it or preserve it were also crazy dangerous. So, for instance, dairy producers, when they would want to make their cheddar cheese more orange, would put in red lead. So now you had lead poisonous cheese. or milk producers at that time. And of course, this is before pasteurization and before any decent refrigeration, milk would rot. They'd use formaldehyde. And they'd use it to such a degree that you can actually go into newspapers of the time and read about embalmed, what they called embalmed milk scandals that were killing children. So the formaldehyde preserved milk was killing children around the country, but there were no prosecutions because it was not illegal, because there were no laws, and there was no way that the consumers would be informed, so, because there's nothing requiring labels.
Yeah, it's just awful. Was strychnine ever used? I can't remember. There were so many other materials that were used in meats, I think.
Yes. I mean, all kinds of borax, you know, we used clean in the kitchen was a 20 mule team borax along with your breakfast bacon or dinner steak. And they use copper sulfate, which is a heavy metal, to turn canned vegetables greener. But strychnine, the 1906 law was the food and drug law. And so strychnine and arsenic were, in fact, legal drugs at that time. Strychnine was a popular pick-me-up, you know, a little jolt of strychnine and you'll be wide awake. And arsenic was used to improve your complexion. It would give you a more, because you were being poisoned by arsenic, you get a very beautiful pale complexion. And then, of course, cocaine and Coca-Cola, that's the origin of the name, or morphine and tooth drops for children. So you start really seeing this unregulated food, drink, and drug kind of environment, which is really scary. I mean, we can laugh about it now, but people died.
A lot of people died.
Yes.
And then we have a guy like Harvey Wiley. Talk about, he's such an interesting guy.
Well, he's a character.
Yeah,
right?
He came from an interesting, was he from Indiana?
He was from Indiana, and he was the son of an itinerant preacher and a conductor on the Underground Railroad and a small town farmer. So he grew up in this to me this was part of his story, he grew up in this highly moral family in which you were put on earth to do good. And he actually, later when he became a chemist, he got his chemistry degree from Harvard. He talked about that chemistry in the service of good. But he was raised in this very small town, 19th century farm family way, in which they grew all their own food. And you know, he like worked on the farm as a kid before he went off to school. And I think that sense of his of what real food was, and that sense of, I used to call him a holy roller chemist, right? Of that higher moral calling really drove him. So he was the first professor of chemistry at Purdue when Purdue was so new they only had a faculty of six. And while he was there, he started investigating food fraud, particularly, I mean, he famously did an investigation of syrup and honey, for instance, in which he was able to show that honey in the grocery store was just dyed corn syrup with some fake honeycomb in it, give you another example. But that kind of work got him to USDA, where he was head of the Bureau of Chemistry, and there he really staked his claim, I guess I should say.
Well, we have some callers online already. Owen in Wyawega, will give you a chance. Hi, thanks for calling.
All right, thank you, Larry. I hope that our contemporary society, that somebody is going to look back 100 years from now and say, the folks in 2019 weren't labeling their fruits and vegetables with the types of chemicals, pesticides, and fungicides that they were exposed to when they were grown. And I'm hoping that eventually we can evolve to where we actually are able to read a label on our fruits and vegetables and be able to divulge and understand the potential hazards of some of the chemicals that the vegetables and fruits we are consuming have been exposed to through the process of growing them.
Yeah. I'm so glad to hear you say that, because one of the things that I, when I'm out really talking about this book and I'm talking about the modern part of it. We have labels. They're not nearly as transparent as they ought to be. And the point you raise is a good one. I mean, what is actually in the food, or just the things that you see on the label that can be mystifying to consumers. And so one of my favorite examples of this, and I'll sound a little snarky, I know when I do it, is cellulose. So you can pick up a label, you'll see it sometimes in grated cheese. They'll use cellulose to keep the cheese from clumping together. But what they don't tell you is that's usually wood pulp, right? And so it's like, so let's say wood pulp, but people say cellulose because it's baffling to the average consumer. And so I keep saying to people, well, tell me if I'm eating a pine or an oak at least, right? Which tree am I gnawing on here in my food? So I want us to go back and revisit the labels. They're better than they used to be, and say, but do people really know what they're eating? Right. Let's see how clear we can make them.
Yeah, we'll get to that. And there's a wonderful final chapter in your book, and I want to talk some more about that eventually. But I also want to get through Harvey Wiley's life a little bit and the Poison Squad itself, because
yes.
He actually experimented on USDA, young men in the USDA, on a whole variety of things that we'd think about it now, and there'd no way, I don't think there'd be any way we could get away with the kind of experiments he did, but they were very useful and served a useful purpose. So we'll talk some more with Deborah Blum here. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with her to talk more about the Poison Squad, one chemist's single-minded crusade for food safety at the turn of the 20th century. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking about food safety and regulation here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, what it looked like at the turn of the 19th century. And with me by phone, Deborah Blum. Deborah is the author of The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. So how safe is the food we eat today? What changes would you like to see in food regulation and safety? What about our history? What about John Wiley, Harvey Wiley, excuse me? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And I did want to mention, we'll be reading the book on Chapter a Day starting on Monday, September 30th. So kind of looking forward to that. It's also the UW-Madison's Go Big Read pick this year for the chancellor picks a book every year, an important book, and then professors use it as part of their instruction. And I'm actually using it in my broadcast class this semester. And so I'm looking forward to hearing what else Deborah has to say. By the way, it's been out a year, but it comes out on paperback on September 24th, isn't it, Deborah?
That's right, next week.
So just next week. So Harvey Wiley was quite a guy, as we were talking about here. But how did he come? Talk about how he came to develop what came to be known as the Poison Squad.
I know, one of the craziest experiments ever done in toxicology. That was actually what got me into the story, was reading about the Poison Squad experiment, in which he decided that the only way that he could figure out to test at food additives in the early 20th century was to poison his colleagues, which is what he did. So he set up this experiment with funding from Congress, so it was pre-approved by Congress, in which they recruited young men in their 20s to volunteer for the experiment. They were clerks and sort of entry-level workers at the Department of Agriculture. And as you remember, Larry, at that time, the Department of Agriculture was the only agency that even looked at food safety. There was no FDA. There was no EPA. It was only the USDA. And there was no consumer protection agency at all. So Wiley and his tiny group were it. And he had gotten increasingly frustrated starting in the 90s about the fact that he kept calling attention to these problems in food and nothing ever happened. So he said, okay, you know, let's just test them on people. We'll skip animal testing. We'll skip all the normal precautionary steps. And we'll just set up this experiment where people eat at our dining room. They built a dining room 7 days a week, 3 meals a day, and half of them just get farm fresh food, and half of them get farm fresh food plus a capsule with the additive of that particular part of the study. And so they looked at borax, and they looked at formaldehyde, and they looked at salicylic acid, which, you know, we know from aspirin, but was then widely used as a food and drink preservative. And they looked at some other heavy metals, and they actually looked at some of the food dyes of the time, which were dangerous. And one of the things that made this such a stunning piece of work was that they started with borax because they thought it would be safe, right? Yeah. I mean, I don't know why they thought that, but they just assumed that it would be safe. And people got really sick. And so Wiley later, when he testified to Congress, and he was like, I was converted by my research. I thought that we should have better labeling. I thought we needed to better inform the consumer. But now what I'm telling you is we have to get this out of the food supply.
Yeah, and boy, was he fought at every step of the way.
Yes, and so one of the things to me that was most fascinating when I was doing all my research at the National Archives was how immediately corrupted the process became, even when he was able to successfully advocate for regulations. There were all these hidden behind-the-scenes handshakes between business and government that he kept getting left out of because he was not a secret handshaker.
And there were, even within the Department of Agriculture, I think James Wiley was the Secretary of Agriculture for a good share of... James Wilson.
Yeah.
And I think he liked Wiley to begin with, but then they, as my memory serves, he became just the opposite. He did not like...
Good memory. He did exactly start as a fan, and then because he saw Wiley as unwilling to compromise with business, he kept writing him and saying, the Agriculture Department is here to promote agriculture, and you keep talking about consumers, right? And so you saw that real tension, and he ran into the same thing with Teddy Roosevelt, right? Yeah, consumers, but you know, we're also here to make sure that business gets its shake.
And on the business side, there were some people who supported him, Heinz, as an example.
Don't you love the Henry Heinz story? I love that story.
Tell that story. It's fascinating to me. He's responsible for the consistency of the ketchup we have today, if I remember from
him. Yeah. So, I mean, and you're right that he's a good example of the fact that we're not trying to tar all business with this evil, corrupt brush. There were also businessmen who wanted to produce a safe product, or as they used to call it back in the day, a pure product, pure food, right? So Henry Heinz, very early on, said, I would like to produce a conservative, preservative-free ketchup. And at the time, ketchups were nothing like what we have today. They were these thin, watery, vegetable-based sausage. They didn't have to be tomato. Some of the most popular ones in the U.S. were sort of you know, food production refuse, all pumpkin rinds and whatever have been scraped off apples to make applesauce. And often it was rotten, so they'd pour in a lot of the preservative sodium benzoate, and then they'd dye it red. And then it was a thin, watery kind of thing that you'd slop out of the bottle. And so Heinz said, what if I wanted to make a ketchup with no preservatives? And he actually put his own scientists to work on that, and they realized they needed two things. They needed vinegar in the ketchup, because vinegar, the acid in vinegar, will kill bacteria. And they needed a lot of the natural acid from the tomatoes themselves, so they needed a thick, pulpy sauce with a lot of tomato pulp in it. And so the ketchup that they made was preservative free. You could bottle it and put it on the shelf in the grocery store, and it didn't grow mold. But it was really hard to get out of the bottle because it was so thick. And so then later, Heinz made a big deal. You remember those ketchup commercials?
Oh, yeah.
Right? You couldn't get the ketchup out of the bottle. But in fact, modern ketchup was invented because Henry J. Heinz wanted to create a preservative free ketchup. And I love that story. I really do.
He had some advocates. There were some very prominent women who fought kind of alongside of him. Alice Lakey, I think, is one that comes to mind.
Jane Addams, the Settlement House, Jane Addams, right? And a lot of women who were in, they leaders of the women's club movement, or even the WCTU. He really courted women, which is very forward looking because women didn't have the vote then. But Wiley actually, when he got married late in life, married a suffragette who was arrested for picketing the Wilson White House in favor of women's votes. And he went out and he courted these women's groups because he thought they were so well organized and so effective at, you know, sort of leading public opinion. So he recruited all kinds of, he talked to suffragette groups and women's clubs around the country. And he even, it was Alice Lakey, who was a big leader in the women's club movement, who persuaded his office to create chemical instructions for the home cook so they could run experiments on their shady food at home. It's really fascinating, right?
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, and I think, what was his wife's name? Anna. I can't remember her maiden name.
Anna Kelton Wiley, that's right.
Anna Kelton Wiley. Well, he was, he did a lot of speaking around the country. He did a lot of writing as well. And the consumers, the public, reacted pretty positively to him, at least.
He was a hugely popular public figure because they saw him as standing up for the working man, the little guy, the person who couldn't afford their own farm, right, had to go to the grocery store, was shopping on a budget, because it was that food, Larry, that food that was, you know, super cheap with all these additives and preservatives and fakes that went to people who were just trying to, you know, feed their family. If you were rich, you could, you know, get higher end stuff. And those were the people that Wiley cared about. So he had an enormous public following. And whenever, you know, the U.S. government pushed back, Roosevelt said this and Taft said this, they found him almost untouchable because he was so beloved by the public. And that he was really good at that. And I think it's important to remember, you know, that while Wiley deserves a lot of credit, and I believe he's a forgotten hero, so do the American people, right? They also really said, we matter here too, in very profound ways.
Absolutely. We have some callers online who have probably a little more modern day questions or comments. Mike in Fond du Lac, let's go to you. Hi, thank you for waiting.
Hi, I have a question about sushi. I love sushi, but I recently discovered that for tuna, they treat it with carbon monoxide to keep it pink. Do you know much about how much the sushi tuna is treated with carbon monoxide?
You know, I don't, but I'll tell you that carbon monoxide is a very volatile gas, so it wouldn't stay in the tuna. I would worry more about the fact that they still use arsenic in chicken feed to make the chicken meat pink, and that was approved by the FDA for cosmetic use about in the 1950s. The Obama administration FDA moved to ban it, and the Trump administration let that ban, relapse. So I actually would worry, if I was worried about tuna, I would worry a bit more about mercury than I would about the carbon monoxide. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike, for calling. Rod in Weyerhaeuser, it's your turn. Hi, Rod.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. Thank you for another good program. God bless you, because you can sure come up with some good programs. Dave, I have two questions and then a point that was ironic when the lady mentioned about Heinz, because I was just reading about him the other day on my stuff, quote, smartphone, unquote. They're not smart. They're amazing. But anyhow, and it was telling about Heinz, and he actually went to England, and when he showed his ketchup to the royalty, they ordered everything he had. They ordered it. They wanted it all. So that tells you they must have liked it. But my question about the food, the Norwegians, Scandinavians, with the lutefisk, they said, well, they soaked it in lye. Well, now I always thought that lye was, connected with Lysol. That's what Lysol was made from. And I'm Polish background, so I don't think I ever even had lutefisk. My uncle, he liked it because around Christmas he would eat it. And my aunt, his wife, my Aunt Violet, she was Norwegian background, so they would have that lutefisk. And my dad used to say, kind of grin, he said, well, he said he liked it because of her, But anyhow, isn't that kind of a poison too? And then my other question was, can I take, beans, when it's hot summer, buy the navy beans hard and soak them in vinegar? I did that. I actually did that. I ate them throughout the week.
There you go. So, well, lutefisk and lye, there is a little history with that. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Deborah.
I'm married to a Norwegian American, so I know lutefisk really well. We eat it every Christmas Eve.
I think in the day when the Norwegians were getting the fish and there wasn't refrigeration, they had to preserve it to get it to the shore, and so they would soak it in lye. That's my memory, and I'm not sure if
That's exactly right. It was cured in lye. And then when you would boil it, as you do with lutefisk, some people bake it, but, then it's kind of washed out. And then a lot of times when you're cooking lutefisk, you boil it or steam it, and you get even more of the lye out. So what you would worry about would be, these part per million, part per billion residual compounds with lye. So if you're worried about it, I love poisonous things. I love poisons. I'm a toxicology journalist. And, so I spend a lot of time saying, which of these things do I worry about? If I ate lutefisk once a year, I wouldn't worry, right? Because the real rule with low-dose toxicology is don't eat the same thing every day. You don't want a part per billion, part per million chemical cellular assault every day. So you just mix it up. Mix it up.
And that's what Wiley
will save your life.
And that's what Wiley was talking about and fighting about. People, the manufacturers might say, well, there's a small amount of this or that. And he would talk about the cumulative effects, right?
Yes, that is a very smart point, because that actually is a kind of foresighted look at what we are realizing now in toxicology, which is that in that case, they had unregulated use of these food additives. So you might get formaldehyde in your milk, but you might also get it in your meat, and you might get borax in the morning. You might also get it at dinner. So you were eating these cumulative doses, and no one knew how much because there were no labels. and no one knew how much because there were no safety standards that said you can only put so much in. And so some people were getting huge doses daily, and he kept saying, we can't allow this, right? These are getting very dangerous when you add them up. So it is exactly that point.
And how did that first law sort of finally come about?
So Wiley had been, like, putting this food and drug law forward for a good 15 years and working with different congressional committees, and it kept getting shot down. And, of course, what changed it is a very famous novel, The Jungle,
yeah,
written by Upton Sinclair, which was, as he would say very bitterly, he was a socialist. He wrote it about the plight of the packing house workers in Chicago, the, you know, poor poorly treated immigrant workers in the Chicago meat packing houses. But what the backstory was, the horrible way that meat was processed, and, you know, they would poison the rats, and the dead rats would go into the sausage, and everything was scummy, and they would just scrape mold off meat and, you know, send it down the line. And so when people read his book, what he said was, I aimed at America's heart and I hit it in the stomach. The huge public reaction was to the fact that there was this horrible story of the meat we ate. But what made it really interesting was that his publisher, Doubleday Page, fact-checked it. And then they sent it to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt fact-checked it. And in both cases, the investigators came back and said it's worse than in the book. And Roosevelt used that report that he commissioned to blackmail Congress. He literally blackmailed Congress with that report into passing the Meat Inspection Act of 1906. And when that act passed, the Food and Drug Law was kind of carried along in his wake. So both of those laws passed in June 1906. And this is a paradigm-shifting moment in the United States because these are the first two federal regulations that are consumer protection regulations. The U.S. government had refused to regulate for consumer protection until that time. And so everything that follows, you know, all of our consumer protections are actually based on the Meat Inspection Act and the Food and Drug Act of 1906.
Well, where do you think we are now? You've given us kind of an idea, I think, about where your thoughts are. But when it comes to food protection in the country,
so we're definitely better off than in the 19th century. The people who really research food safety say that in the 19th century, food was one of the top 10 causes of death in the United States. And if you look at our list of top 10 causes of death now, the food's not on it, right? But we still have about, and this is interesting, CDC calculates about 3,000 or so Americans die every year from food poisoning. And about 40% of that is what we think of as bacterial food poisoning. The other 50 to 60%, we don't know. I mean, they actually call it undisclosed ingredients in food. So we're not killing as many people with food, but people are still dying from things in their food in this country, right? And if you're one of the unlucky 3,000, then this is going to be a very big deal to you, right? Or the 50,000 who end up in the hospital. So food is not what we want it to be. And our real problem today is that we do have some good protections on the book. We're not enforcing them in all cases. We're not funding them in all cases. And in some cases, we're just rolling them back. And probably the best quick example of that is that this week, the Trump administration rolled back meat inspections for the pork industry. And they're actually going to reduce the number of government inspectors that, you know, look for diseased meat on the line by 40% and just let the industry self-regulate. And that's basically, you know, 1905, right?
Right. Back to 1905.
That's exactly right. And they are now are proposing let the beef industry do the same thing. So
so on that happy note,
yes.
Deborah, I am looking forward to hearing you speak when you come to the UW campus for your good Go Big Read book Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I promise it won't all be depressing. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, and we start reading her book on Chapter a Day on September 30th. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.